Welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I'm very happy to welcome back to this radio program Neil Faulkner. Neil Faulkner is a historian and an archaeologist. We talked to him last year about his book, A People's History of the Russian Revolution. Today, we're going to talk to him about another fascinating book. It's called A Radical History of the World. Neil Faulkner joins me over Skype. Mr. Faulkner, always a great pleasure to have you back on this radio program.
Great pleasure to be with you, Mitch.
And we'll see how much through world history we can get in the next 50 minutes or so.
It's going to be a challenge.
I'll let you bring in all the examples you want, but I want to begin really with your second chapter, which is about the first civilizations that we find. And you begin your second chapter like this. I'm going to quote it. Quote, in certain parts of the world from around 3000 BC, especially in the fertile river valleys of Mesopotamia, Egypt, Pakistan, and China, the first fully formed class societies emerged. Priests, war leaders, and civil officials used their positions to monopolize control over surpluses, impose their authority on the rest of society, and begin to exploit the labor of others in their own interests. Is this a cycle of civilization we'd see ever since? Evermore?
Well, I don't know about cycle. I think I'd put it slightly differently, because I don't think in the period since then we have ever really been in a position where we haven't had an elite which is creaming off the bulk of the surplus and then using the surplus being produced by society to engage in various forms of competition. I think there have been moments in time over the last, let's say, 5,000 years when the proportion of the available wealth going to the common people, the ordinary people, has been somewhat higher. There have been periods, in other words, where the class differences in society have been less marked. And there have even been moments occasionally where the very existence of class society has been called into question. But I think invariably they have been moments. And we have to think of the history of the last 5,000 years, sadly, as really a history where different elites, political elites and military elites and economic elites, have been competing with each other and have been using the resources of society or misusing the resources of society to pursue various kinds of competition between themselves that have never really been in the interests of the ordinary people. And I think that that remains the case right up to the present. So that's one of my broad generalizations for the book, Mitch, where I'm explaining the origins of class society, and I'm trying to explain what I mean by classes in terms of different degrees of control over surplus. But then I'm suggesting that this actually is a pattern that runs through 5,000 years right up to the present. So I'm creating a kind of foundation block, really, for the understanding of the whole of subsequent human history, including our own age.
What's so significant about year 3000 BC and the formation of what we consider our first civilizations, again, in Sumer, which is modern-day Iraq, Egypt, yeah. Pakistan. I mean, we always think of farming and things, but we had farming before this. We had societies before this, I guess, maybe much smaller.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what is happening, and it's, of course, it's not general across the world at this time. It's happening in certain places where the, at first in certain places, where the agriculture is incredibly rich. And it's these alluvial floodplains of the great river valleys where you get such rich agriculture and such dense populations of people working the land that it becomes possible to accumulate significant surpluses. Now, what's a significant surplus? Well, it's the kind of surplus that enables you, if you're thinking in archaeological terms, it enables you to construct great monuments. So when we think about, you know, great monuments, let's take the Nile Valley, the great monuments which dominate the Nile Valley from round about 3000 BC are, of course, the world famous pyramids. Well, you need a lot of surplus wealth to create a great monument like that. But I think the surpluses in these early river valley civilizations are also being used in ways that are less immediately archaeologically visible to us in the present. But we can be certain that they were being used in this way because we've got the historical sources to suggest that that's the case. They're very often, these surpluses, being invested in armies, being invested in military power, being invested in a process of empire building, being invested in processes of political centralization and social control, all of which are really about building the power and the wealth of the elite.
Speaking of the pyramids in Egypt, you write this, quote, "The pyramids were designed to teach people their place. They were ideological weapons in a class war."
Yeah, and I think that's right. I mean, what does the pyramid say? First of all, the pyramid is constructed by conscripting the labor of large numbers of ordinary Egyptians or slaves of the Egyptians. I don't think we know exactly who was building the pyramids, but we can assume that the bulk of the unskilled heavy labor was not being done voluntarily. So however it's being done, there's a degree of coercion involved in this. Now, the very fact that there's an elite powerful enough to set people to work doing this is a way of demonstrating the power of that elite. And then I think the monument stands there as a monument to a ruler who is claiming to be a god, a ruler who not only claims to be a god, but also claims that when he dies, he continues in some sense to exist. So the ruler is elevated above the common herd, as it were, and that's symbolized by the magnificence, the grandeur, the monumentality of his tomb. I think living in the shadow of the pyramids, it would have been difficult not to have been awed by the power of the political elite.
Some say we see slavery at the very beginning of civilization because cities, which civilizations are based off, were actually terrible places to live with disease and hardship and these things.
Yeah, I think the ancient city, the medieval city, the early modern city. I mean, cities really up until well after the Industrial Revolution and the development of proper urban infrastructures were very grim places to live indeed. And certainly ancient society, to a lesser degree, medieval society, ancient society was heavily dependent on slave labor to do a lot of the jobs that nobody else, frankly, wanted to do. So when we think about the great monuments, not just the pyramids, we might think about the Greek temples, or we might think about the great Roman bathhouses, monuments like that, we can be pretty certain were being constructed by slave labor, probably by people who'd been captured in war, because that was the standard thing in the ancient world. If you lost a war, people would be enslaved en masse and then put to work for the victors, for the conquerors. So these monuments are monuments to slavery and monuments to the fact that this is a society in which most of the people who are citizens of these societies, I'm thinking particularly now of Greece and Rome, they're free citizens with citizen rights, probably with a degree of property of their own. So they have a measure, they're not part of the elite, but they have a measure of privilege, a measure of protection within this society. So the really hard grafting in these societies, in the Greek world, in the Roman Empire and so on, is probably being done by slave labor.
Neil Faulkner, you write about the development of history. Let's talk about that before we get back into it. Well, we could use historical examples, obviously, to highlight what we're going to dive into. But the drivers of history, and these are my words, but this is what I took from what I read in your book, are technological advancements, political rivalry or power rivalry, and class struggle.
Yeah. Yeah, I do see it like that, Mitch. I think three major drivers that are interacting with each other. You see, what's clear if you look at the very long term there is a gradual accumulation of knowledge, of science, of skill, of technology, or to put it in a kind of rounded terms, a rising ability of us to, as a species, to produce the things that we need to live a good life, a rising productivity of labour, if you like, because we're producing more and more efficient labour-saving technologies. Now, that's clearly a major, major factor in the development of human civilization. An example I like to quote very often is to contrast stone tool technology with iron technology. And what I say to people is, actually, the Iron Age was a technological revolution as significant as the Industrial Revolution, because the difference between trying to chop down a tree to clear the land with a stone axe and trying to do the same job with an iron axe is a total transformation in the capacity of human beings to work the land. So that's clearly a major driver of human social development. But then a second driver is the thing we've already discussed a bit, the way in which elites throughout history have appropriated the surplus, or a large part of the surplus, and have used it to build monuments, to live in luxury themselves, but primarily to compete with one another, which means to a large degree those surpluses are being wasted, particularly in warfare. And then I think a third driver, and all of these three drivers, they're sort of interacting with each other to give us the extraordinary complexity that is human historical development. That third driver is the struggle of the common people from below to try and win for themselves a bigger share of the wealth that they, in fact, are producing so that they can live a better life. And that brings them into conflict with an elite which is concerned to control as much surplus as possible, partly because they want the surplus for themselves, but also because they're engaging in competition with other elites. And it's the complex interaction of these three things: our ability, our growing ability to produce wealth, the way in which wealth is misused by political elites, and the struggle of ordinary people for the control over the wealth that they are creating. It's the interaction of these three drivers that gives us the historical process as a whole, I think.
That's the key, the creation of a surplus and then the control of the surplus.
Yeah, yeah. That's how I said. I mean, I don't think you can really properly understand what is going on, actually, at any period in history over the last 5,000 years. I don't really think you can properly understand it unless you've grasped the centrality of the question of surplus. But the way I sometimes describe it is to say that there's a basic cycle which operates in traditional society, where traditional societies produce the things that they need, they consume those things, and then they produce them again in the next cycle. And, you know, it's the traditional agricultural cycle driven by the seasons, the growing of the crops, and the reproduction of the herds and the people feeding themselves and the people reproducing. That's a kind of cyclical process, in a sense. But that is repetitive. It's not actually in and of itself a major historical driver. It's what drives history, really, is what's happening to the surplus over and above what is necessary for basic subsistence, what is necessary for society simply to reproduce itself. What we've got in addition to that, the surplus, is available to do other things with. And how we use that surplus can then vary enormously from society to society, depending on how power is distributed. We could, for example, decide that what we're going to do with our surplus is to invest. I'm thinking about today, Mitch. I'm bringing it right up to the present. We're going to invest our surplus in a new arms race. We could choose to do that, or the elites who dominate our lives could choose to do that. Or we could say, no, the priority actually is to deal with the sick and the disabled and to improve the quality of our healthcare systems. And so what we're going to do is invest our surplus in a huge improvement and a making more available of good quality healthcare. Now, in either case, what you're doing is you're using a surplus which is potentially available over and above what's necessary for basic subsistence. And I think you can use it in a negative way or you can use it in a progressive way.
We are in conversation with Neil Faulkner. Neil Faulkner is a historian and an archaeologist. He is the author of the book that we're talking about. It's called A Radical History of the World. Neil Faulkner, let's then get into the Iron Age. And this is the Bronze Age is what, around 3000 to 1000 BC, roughly?
Yeah. I mean, the exact dates depend on where you are in the world, but that's a good kind of ballpark area. Yes, 3000 to 1000 BC.
Okay, and then right around and maybe just a little after 1000 BC, we get into the Iron Age. And I have to say, when I was reading your chapter on the Iron Age, in some ways, I kept thinking about the internet when I was reading about iron.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are parallels. It doesn't really matter what period of technology you are looking at. The new technology can have a major impact on society. One of the things I say about the Iron Age is this. I talk about it as being democratic as opposed to bronze being aristocratic. And what I have in mind there is the availability of iron to just about anybody, really, means that not only can the local peasantry re-equip themselves, the ordinary farmers re-equip themselves with much more efficient iron tools, they can also equip themselves with armaments. You can bash out a spear in the village blacksmiths as easily as you can bash out a plowshare or a spade. And once you put weapons in the hands of ordinary men, then you are creating a different kind of society than a society where weapons are largely in the hands of an elite because they are extremely expensive items of equipment, which they were unquestionably in the Bronze Age. In the Bronze Age, you get a kind of warfare in which aristocrats are fighting it out with each other. In the Iron Age, you get mass armies. In the case of Greece and Rome, mass armies formed of a city-state militia. And so power is shifting. As we move from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age, power is shifting from an aristocratic elite to a mass citizenry. And you can see the way much, much later, you've mentioned the, you know, the digital age, you've mentioned the internet, the same much, much later. I mean, we're having debates now, aren't we, about the impact of the internet and who controls it. Is it controlled by big business? Is it controlled by right-wing political forces who are manipulating the messages which are being transmitted online? Or, on the other hand, is it something which is democratizing communications, which is enabling ordinary people to find an easy voice for themselves and a way of reaching out to many others, such that we can have very sudden mobilizations of ordinary people who've been brought together on the basis of internet communication? And I'm thinking of things like the Occupy movement, for example. And we're actually debating this right now. We're debating what is the impact of the new communications technology and how does it bear upon the balance between different social forces in society, different political forces.
It is in the Iron Age, around 500 BC or so, where we get the birth of Athenian democracy. How yes. significant is that?
Well, I think it's hugely significant. It's possibly the single clearest example of what I'm talking about when I talk about the revolutionary potential of an Iron Age technology in empowering people who are lower down in the social hierarchy, lower down in the class structure. I think what happens at the end of the 6th century BC in Athens is that we get what could be described as a hoplite revolution. It is sometimes described as a hoplite revolution, and it creates a democracy. It's called a hoplite revolution because it seems to have been a revolution in Athens and elsewhere in Greece, driven by this middling sort of relatively prosperous free citizen farmers who were prosperous enough to be able to equip themselves as hoplites. And hoplites were just, they were the heavy infantry of the city-state militia. And if you were wealthy enough, if you were prosperous enough and you could equip yourself in that way, you would do your military service as a citizen of Athens, serving as a hoplite in the phalanx. And what seems to have happened at the end of the 6th century BC is that this class of people effectively overturn the old order and establish a new kind of constitution, which was a participatory democracy. And it was literally a participatory democracy in that political power in Athens through the 5th and the 4th centuries BC, it was held by a citizen assembly called the Ecclesia, and every single free-born adult male citizen was entitled to attend and to have a say and to vote. And there were probably about 30,000 of them altogether. Now, that's an extraordinary kind of democracy from below. And I think what it does is it creates a mass audience for culture. And so also in the 5th century BC, what's sometimes called the Golden Age of Athens, we get this explosion of cultural creativity because there's a mass audience for all of the things that are being done by the scientists, the philosophers, the dramatists, the artists, the architects, all these people. And I think that brief period, it's only a few decades really, that brief period in the history of Athens in the 5th century BC, one of the most creative periods, culturally speaking, in the whole of human history. And it was an extraordinary thing, an extraordinary moment in time. And I think it was the democracy that made it possible.
And I find the Ecclesia interesting because this is sort of where we get an assembly from the Ecclesia, is it?
Yes, indeed.
And that's funny because I always thought of Ecclesia or ecclesiastic as a religious term. But it's actually a democratic body, an Athenian.
Originally, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. It's a coming together of people in assembly. We actually know where they met, where the Athenian ecclesia met. It met on the Pnyx Hill, which is on the edge of the city. It's quite high up where the city walls were built, and it's, you can go there today, and it's just a large open area. There's been some shaping of the stone, but it's essentially a natural open space. And they obviously met there because it was a place where the speaker could be seen and could address a large audience, with, one hopes, most, if not all, of the people who'd come to the meeting able to hear what was being said. And they would, you know, anybody who put, as we understand it, anybody who put their hand up was entitled to speak, and at the end of the debate there would be a vote, and the citizen body as a whole would decide on the major issues of the day. Are we going to go to war, or are we going to make peace? Are we going to receive this embassy? Are we going to send an embassy to another city-state? All of these very important decisions, which are now made by elected representatives. In ancient Athens, they were being made by the voters themselves.
Neil Faulkner, in my own surveying of history, and I'm no historian, I'm just a radio guy. We're talking about whether it be Athenian democracy, whether if it would be, say, the last 100 years of the Roman Republic before it would become an empire with the uprisings led by people like Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, whether it be the French Revolution 1700 years later, or whether it even be the fight for civil rights in the United States, I've always seen history as one constant driver has always been this struggle for enfranchisement, to be involved somehow in the decision-making bodies.
I think that's absolutely right, Mitch. That is something that runs through the whole history of class societies. And I think the reason it happens is this, because it is never really in the interests of the elite for the common people to be empowered, because insofar as the common people are empowered, the priorities of society are almost bound to change, and they're almost bound to change in a direction which is not in the interests of the elite. It's almost invariably going to be, actually, we need to spend less on castles and more on feeding the poor at the castle gate. We need to spend less on armaments and more on building hospitals. Invariably, insofar as the common people are empowered through a more democratic constitution, more democratic political system, you're going to get that challenging of elite control of wealth. So I do think the struggle for democracy is a constant through the whole history of class society. And I don't even think it's the case that you can point to one society or the other and you can say that's where democracy is invented. I mean, people very often, they point to ancient Athens and they say that's where democracy was invented. Well, elements of democracy were certainly, in our sense, were certainly present in 5th century BC Athens. But what is equally true is that this was a slave society. It was a patriarchal society, and it was a society that jealously guarded the citizenship, or if you could say, another way of putting that might be to say it was very nationalistic, very nativist, very xenophobic. Now, we would say we don't recognize that as democracy. We would say that everybody should be entitled to a vote and a participation in the political process. That's real democracy. So, I mean, I don't think it's right to say that the Greeks invented democracy, but there's an element of real participatory democracy in the way they're doing things. And then later, you see, you get upsurges again where people are fighting for democracy. And you're quite right to say, in the civil rights movement in the United States in the 1950s and the 1960s, what was that? That was a struggle for democracy. And we've still got it today. We've still got these clashes today. The Occupy movement, what's the Occupy movement saying, in effect, you know, in the United States and elsewhere? It's saying, in effect, we're being disenfranchised. The reality is that the voices of the 99% don't count in the same way as the voice of the 1%, that democracy isn't really functioning properly in order to represent the interests of ordinary people. What the decision-making process is dominated by the corporations. So we've still got that struggle for democracy going on all the time, I think.
Yeah. When I look at it, I think of, if we talk about, again, the struggle for, I like to call it enfranchisement, being involved somehow, like you had in ancient Athens, how you had in the final century of the Roman Republic or the civil rights movement today. I think a lot of the immigrant rights movement here in the United States, where we basically have what I think one could call a permanent underclass of society.
No, I go with that completely. And I think that, I mean, if we want to touch on the present, because I mean, I deal with it quite a bit in the book, of course, in the latter parts of the book. I think we are facing a very, very serious crisis today on a whole series of fronts, actually. I mean, a very, very serious world crisis is now unfolding. It has economic elements, it has social elements, it's to do with the breakup of the geopolitical order, it's to do with the problem of climate change, and in particular it's to do with the rise of nationalism and racism and what I think is effectively fascism in the United States, in Europe, and indeed in the wider world, with a visceral kind of scapegoat politics, which is being directed particularly against migrants all over the world and particularly against Muslims over very large parts of the world. And I think we have to say that the signs are there. If you look back, not very far in history, actually, you only have to look back to the 1930s and the 1940s to see the dangers implicit in this kind of politics. And I do think that the litmus test of our decency our civilization is that we stand by those who are most oppressed. We stand by those who are under attack. And I think we should be standing four square with migrants and with Muslims and with other people who are being targeted by the far right in the context of a very deep global crisis, which is as serious, if not more serious, than the global crisis that the world faced in the 1930s, with this additional element of the danger of climate catastrophe, the growing danger of climate catastrophe.
Neil Faulkner is our guest. He is the author of the book, A Radical History of the World. It is what we are in conversation about. Neil Faulkner, comparing now to the 1930s, say, I find that interesting because this year we're marking the 100th anniversary of the armistice that brought an end to World War I. And in some ways, that period reminds me of this period now. Not that we fought a world war, though we can argue about the war on terrorism, but we don't have time to do that. I don't want to go down that route. We haven't fought a world war, but what people say that plunged Europe into crisis after World War I was a failure in liberalism, which perhaps we could say there was a failure in liberalism with the economic recession 10 years ago that has once again plunged us into crisis.
Yeah, I think we have a crisis. If we think about it in political terms, we have a crisis of the liberal center. And I think you're absolutely right to say there was a crisis of the liberal centre in the 1920s and the 1930s. The 1920s are sometimes thought of as, you know, they're the roaring 20s, aren't they? And there are a lot of images associated with the 1920s of a kind of prosperity and a carefree society and living it up and so on. But actually, at the base of society, there was a lot of suffering, there was a lot of unrelieved poverty, there was a lot of unemployment. And then with the 1929 crash, much larger numbers of people are plunged into destitution. And in the face of that crisis, particularly as it unfolds between 1929 and 1933, when it's at its worst, you get a complete collapse, it seems to me, of the liberal centre and an inability of the liberal centre to provide solutions, which means that the choice becomes a choice between the revolutionary left and the fascists. And essentially what is happening in Europe in the 1930s is that the fascists are winning. And by the time the Second World War breaks out in 1939, virtually the whole of Europe is under one form of far-right government or another. The only major exceptions actually are France and Britain before the war actually breaks out. Now, I think we are in a rather similar place. I'm very struck when I look at the politics of the United States, Britain, Europe, the areas that I'm most familiar with, though to some degree it applies elsewhere as well. I think what's happening is we have a liberal political elite that is wedded to a neoliberal economic model, which has quite clearly failed. And it failed in 2008. And the failure of that system in 2008, with its excessive financialization, with its hoovering of wealth to the top, with its hugely powerful, wealthy international banks, that's the root of it, and that's what went so obviously badly, hopelessly wrong in 2008. The complete failure to come up with any real alternative to that busted economic model, for me, that's what's creating a space for the rapid growth of the far right. And there's a difference here, I think, Mitch, with what was happening certainly in the later 1940s, as the world came out of the Second World War. And you had, in response to the Depression and then the experience of the war, you had the development of a new kind of economics. We call it Keynesian. I don't know whether you use that term in the States.
We use it in, on this show, we do. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Okay, fine. I mean, Keynesian economics, where you had the sense that it was the role of the state to be heavily involved in economic management, to prevent recessions, to build a welfare state, to provide a kind of safety net for people when they were in periods of unemployment and so on, all of that. And the effect of that was actually to underpin the great boom, which ran through the 1950s and the 1960s into the 1970s. So you had emerging out of the experience of the Depression an alternative model that worked. And it was an alternative model, of course, which strengthened the liberal center and made world capitalism relatively stable in that period. Nothing remotely like that has emerged since 2008. And we have a liberal center, a liberal elite, if you like, that offers nothing. And I think that's why Hillary Clinton lost the election to Donald Trump, because Clinton represented an old, failed liberal central establishment. And I think that's the picture across Europe as well, that these politicians who have got no ideas, no imagination, are not really offering any the big, bold, brave solutions, programs that people are looking for. Because they're not doing it, they are losing ground very rapidly to the far right.
I think there's still a lot of confusion about the term liberalism and liberal, and as you call the center liberal. Can you talk to me about what that is, and perhaps diving into history, its connection to what we consider the Enlightenment of the 18th century?
Yeah, it's terribly difficult because, of course, the terms and these political terms are very slippery, aren't they? And they tend to be used in different ways in different societies. So liberal has a slightly different meaning in the States from the meaning that it has in Britain and in other parts of Europe and so on. The way I would put it is this. I'd actually put it in a slightly more dichotomous way. I think I put it like this. What I would say emerges from the Enlightenment and the French Revolution in the 18th century is the sense that there is a striving for equality and democracy and peace. And that, in a sense, is associated with the left. And on the other side, there is a reaction to the revolutionary experience and the ideals of the revolution. And I think the far right, and perhaps in a more general sense, conservatism, is rooted in that 18th century reaction to the French Revolution. And I think in some sense, through the 19th century and the 20th century, right up to the present, there is a nest of ideas which are associated with the left of center. Ideas about equality, ideas about democracy, ideas about civil rights, ideas about which are sort of driven by a humanitarian and an idealistic view of what human society should be like on one side, and on the other, a conservative reaction to that, which accepts high levels of inequality, regards that as inevitable, a view of the world which is rooted in a negative view of human nature. People are naturally greedy, people are naturally militaristic, an acceptance of competition and all of those things. Now, I do see quite a sharp dichotomy between these two. And I see the liberal centre, what I'm describing as the liberal centre, sort of straddling that ground between the two. And that's fine as long as society is relatively stable and the economy is growing and society as a whole, the majority of people are reasonably content with the way things are, the liberal center can hold. When that ceases to be the case, when society goes into crisis, when people are looking for a new way of doing things, when people are demanding radical responses to what is going on, that's where the liberal center collapses. And you get a polarization to left and to right. Now, I'm a socialist. My view is that sort of seesawing will go on as long as we have a class society in which you've got a minority of people, a small number of people who are very wealthy, and a majority of people who are forced to work for a living at a much more modest level. I think that class struggle means that there's sort of permanent political instability built into our lives. And I do believe, actually, I mean, I honestly do believe that if we want equality and democracy and peace, and if we want a society that is geared to human need, not to the enrichment of the few, then we actually need a society where the ordinary people, in their great majority, have immediate direct control over the resources of society. And, you know, so for me, what does liberalism mean for me? Well, liberalism means this. I mean, if I make it concrete, because I think you always have to try and make things concrete, I would say this. What does it mean in terms of how you run a local hospital, a public hospital here in Britain? It means for me that it should be run by the doctors and the nurses and the ancillary workers and representatives of the patients in the local community which the hospital serves. It shouldn't be run by private owners. It shouldn't be run by government appointees. It shouldn't be run by a corporate management. It should be run from below by the people who work in it and the people who use it. Now, what does the liberal centre say about that? I think the liberal centre finds it difficult to decide which side it is on.
Neil Faulkner, again, because it is the 100th anniversary of the armistice bringing the end of World War One, war that was supposed to end all wars, but quite the opposite. But you write in your book, A Radical History of the World, that this is really the first major war between capitalist societies.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I think what you've got is, through the 19th century, you've got a growing number of European countries are achieving national unity. They're creating a unified national market, and they're beginning their industrial revolution. It's at different stages in different countries. But by 1914, you've got a very high level of industrialization, a very high level of industrial capacity to produce armaments. What you've got at the same time is a continent which is deeply dysfunctional as a geopolitical system. And it still is. I mean, this is a characteristic of Europe historically. Europe is the continent of warring states. It is the continent which, since the fall of the Western Roman Empire, has been divided into a large number of medium-sized states which are rivals with each other. And I think what happens in 1914 is you get a fusion of that traditional geopolitical dysfunctionality, that division into rival nation states that are competing for power and territory within Europe, that fuses with industrial power and with the rivalry between different corporations based in different countries, which are rivals for raw materials, for markets, for investment opportunities, and so on. And so 1914 becomes two things at the same time: a traditional European civil war to decide which country is going to expand its territory at the expense of which other, and at the same time, a war between rival corporations that control major industries. And that war is now being fought, and this is what makes it so terrible, so protracted and so bloody. That war is now able to be fought with the output of fully industrialized or partially industrialized economies. So you get stalemate and a war of attrition and a war which is determined by who can produce the most battleships, who can invent tanks, who can produce the most guns and increase output of shells, who can put more men into uniform and send them into the trenches, and so on. And you end up with 15 million dead. And 15 million dead who are the dead of an industrialization of conflict between nation states and conflict between big corporations, essentially.
So we're still living in the shadow of the First World War.
We are. I mean, very much. I mean, Gabriel Kolko famously described the period from 1914 onwards as the century of war, in a sense, coming up to the centenary of the end of the war. We're coming to the end of that century of war. And that's exactly what it has been. 15 million dead in the First World War. And then the thing, in a sense, is rerun 20 years later. And there are 60 million dead in the Second World War. And probably if we add together the dead of all of the wars of the last century, the total is probably in the region of 100 million people. Now, anybody who thinks that this is a sensible way to organize human affairs, anybody who thinks that the division of the world into the states that exist today, the division of the world into competing corporations, the division of the world in such a way that periodically you get these horrendous cycles of slaying. Anybody who thinks that that's a sensible way to organize things must be mad. We must be capable as a species. We're so talented, so creative. We have such productive powers. We have such imagination and intellect. We must be capable as a species of so ordering our affairs that we are using our resources not to kill one another, but to feed the hungry and to cure the sick and to educate our children and to all of us together live a better life. And so, I mean, I'm on the one hand, I'm very, very pessimistic because I look at that century of warfare, as you say, you know, living in the shadow of the First World War. We're still with it in the sense that we're still in a world of war, of killing, of mass displacement and so on. We're still in that. And that makes me quite pessimistic. And on the other, I look at it and I think, well, it is mad. Most people recognize that it's mad. And we have such capacity as a species to do good. It must be possible for us to put this right so that we don't live through another century of war like the last one.
Neil Faulkner, we're down to our final couple of minutes here. You survey all of world history, and we've mostly focused on Europe, but you've surveyed more really all over the globe of the past. Yeah. Oh, I don't know, 10,000 years or so. I skipped your first chapter, so I hope you won't mind in our conversation about hunter and gatherers and all that development. But what I want to ask you finally here is there anything in your surveying the world history this way that really stood out for you, maybe that you weren't anticipating?
I think it is this. It's the degree to which the interventions from below of ordinary people shape the historical process, not necessarily in ways that they anticipate, and more often than not, without them realizing their highest ideals. Most of the great struggles from below don't achieve the maximum goals, the maximum aims that the popular movement sets itself. What happens more often than not is that there is a limited advance, there are limited gains, there is ultimately disappointment. However, even when there is disappointment, it seems to me that it is above all the intervention of ordinary people from below that is absolutely crucial in all progressive change. And if I can just give one example of what I mean by that. Let's take your Civil War. The American Civil War is the second stage of the American Revolution. And ultimately, there is disappointment. It doesn't lead to the complete emancipation of black people in the United States of America, because they fight again, of course, they're forced to fight again in the civil rights movement. And it's still today the case that there is a massive problem of racism in the United States and we have Black Lives Matter and so on. The struggle of black people for their emancipation continues. However, what's unquestionably true is that the movement for emancipation, the abolitionist movement that involved both black people and white people, and then the enrollment of very large numbers of emancipated slaves, freed slaves, in the Union Army to help that process of completing the victory of the Union side in the Civil War. That was an intervention from below by ordinary people that hugely advanced the interests of black people in the United States. Now, so what you have to say about that? Of course, it's terribly disappointing the way in which you get the emergence of the Jim Crow laws, Reconstruction comes to an end, you get the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. There are all kinds of setbacks subsequently. So the struggle is not brought to a final definitive conclusion. It's not an outright victory. Nonetheless, it is a major milestone in the development of the black struggle in the United States, and in the process of turning the United States into a far more civilized country than it would otherwise have been.
Neil Faulkner, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Again, Neil Faulkner is a historian, an archaeologist, and author of the book that we have been in conversation about. It's called A Radical History of the World.